It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Herb Douglas is a Pittsburgh native. At 97 years young, he is the nation's oldest surviving African-American Olympic medalist. And he's the subject of a new book, Launched, The Life of Olympian Herb Douglas. We recently visited at a fitting location, the Heinz History Center, home to the Western Pennsylvania Sports Museum. Herb Douglas, my pleasure. Welcome to The Confluence.
Well, it's a pleasure to be home.
Herb, I wanted to start with, I assume as a kid, that you used to love running and jumping and all that. Am I right about that?
During my time as I was a child, there were no supermarkets. There were only corner stores. And on Hazelwood Avenue, one block down, was Butler's store. And I'd go down there because my mother didn't have much inventory of food, and she'd send me down there to pick up salt, pepper, whatever. And I'd go down to that store and run back up Hazelwood Avenue, that block. Now, what did that do? It conditioned me when I was 8, 9, and 10, and I didn't know it. And at Colfax, when they had their little city meet, I would win. I never lost a race in elementary school and only one in junior high.
When did you go from running to the jumping? Because that's where you made your fame, the long jump.
Because of Jesse Owens. He did the three. He did the 100, the 220 yards, and also the broad jump, as we called it in America. But it has always been the long jump in the nomenclature of the Olympic movement.
And you met Jesse Owens when?
14 years old. My mother took me to meet Jesse Owens at the Watts Street School, elementary school. And as I met Jesse Owens, I shook his hand, and immediately I said, "Mr. Owens, I run the 100-yard dash," because we ran yards during that time. And I said, "In 10-3, and I told him my long jump, the broad jump during that time, 21 feet. And he said, "You did better than me." Then I later learned, as we became friends, he jumped 23 feet in junior high and 24 feet 11 inches in high school.
So you were 26 at the time of the 48 games in London. Do you think you were at your peak there, or was this maybe your last time to make the Olympics?
Well, psychologically, I felt as though it was my last time to try to make the team. Because, as you know, they didn't have an Olympic in 1940, and this was my chance. I felt as though if I got to the age of 30, I'd be too old. Although there were two 30-year-old guys on that team that placed. And that was Barney Ewell from Penn State in the 100. He placed second. And Cochran from Indiana won the 400-meter hurdles. So they were like 32 years old.
That was determination because, as you mentioned, no Olympics in 40 and 44 because of World War II. It was like, did you almost feel like you missed your opportunity, missed your chance?
I actually believe that I'd have put more energy into it in 1944, when I was 22 years old. I was too young for the previous Olympic, but I actually believe I reached my peak at the age of 22.
According to the U.S. Olympic Committee, I believe there are 300 athletes on the U.S. team in 48, the London Games, 262 men and 38 women. Did you have many African-American teammates?
Eight.
Eight?
Yeah, Mal Whitfield, who won the 800 meters. A close friend, there's a writing of him and I. We've been friends ever since 1942. 76, 77 years this year. We've been friends. That's Harrison Dillard. And he upset all the world's fastest runners and won the 100 meters. And then Barney Ewell, Bolin. Dave Bolin was great, and Ed Conwell was a sprinter, and he had an upset. He had a problem physically, and they sent him home. But he was the fourth man on the relay team and couldn't compete.
Did you feel, because of so few African-American teammates, did you feel lonely at all? Did you feel your teammates sort of understood your experience?
Well, they understood our experience naturally, but we all, during that time, they put us in a Quonset, the Royal Air Force, and we all were there in this one place. Now, what did that do? We bumped off of one another, just like Mandela did, and they put them all in one precinct, and he comes out and becomes president. And then we discuss between us, we're going to all go back with a medal. We bumped off of one another.
You mentioned Jesse Owens a few minutes ago. Many years ago, I had the thrilling opportunity to interview Mr. Owens about his experience at the 36 games in Berlin. Now, your experience was 12 years later, and I would think a much friendlier city, London, compared to Hitler's Berlin. But I want to know, how were you treated as an African-American athlete, either by your countrymen or by people in Europe, whatever?
Well, when we went over there, we were accepted, those of us of color, more so than we had been here, by far. And we were still in the process of proving to people that we could compete against anybody in the world. Because Jesse Owens proved that. That was a Renaissance spirit, if you're not aware. He won how many medals?
Four.
Name the other four.
You got me.
I know it. I know it. That's why I mentioned it, because no one, they didn't print that. Because they were African Americans. We won 55% of the total gold medals in track and field.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. We're at the Heinz History Center, home of the Western Pennsylvania Sports Museum. We're talking with Herb Douglas. He is the nation's oldest surviving African-American Olympic medalist, and he's the subject of a new book launched, The Life of Olympian Herb Douglas. When you got that medal, can you tell us what you were feeling, what the experience was like?
You know, I was spellbound. I was up there standing, and it's hard when you hear the American flag go up, the Star Spangled Banner. I didn't win it, but Willie Steele won the event, and it was just like it was representing me, my country.
How did your athletic experience, maybe your preparation, the discipline sort of prepare you for the corporate world?
Track and field taught me to be the persistent person, arrange yourself. I never failed. I had to work 10 or 20 accounts a day, and I did that. Now, where did I get the strength from? Physically, track and field. And then the mental strength, I got it because I was determined. And I hate to say this, but I always thought I'd be a winner. And that's what I grew up with because my dad was a winner.
Your success, including your Olympic success, I guess it opened up some doors for you. You met other athletes, I believe Joe Frazier. But also more recently, you met with President Obama. Can you tell us what those experiences were like?
Oh, sure. People are people. And I would put in a category that they were just as great. I met six presidents: Reagan, Bush, Clinton, two other presidents I met, Ford, and no, I met Ford too also. I met two African descent head of states, Mandela, Nelson Mandela, and Obama. Now, when I met Nelson Mandela, Chancellor Nordenberg was with me. And as he ascended from the steps, come down, he walked right over to me and he said, "Welcome, Herb." And I said, "Oh, he's done his homework. He didn't go to Nordenberg or anyone else. He came right to me." And I responded by saying, "You remind me of Sugar Ray Robinson," because I knew he was a champion boxer in his country. And that hit it off. And then at the end, I said, "How did you adjust to the adversity that you went through and become the president of South Africa?" And he said, "Herbert, you do what you have to do."
My final question, Herb. You are the subject of the new book, Launched, The Life of Olympian Herb Douglas. What do you want people to know about Herb Douglas, whether it's from your athletic career or during your at any time during your life?
Family. That is superior to me, even over becoming one of the world's best athletes. The home training I got to become that. And the home training I got to sit down and discuss this with you, because I don't do it that much.
Herb Douglas is a Pittsburgh native, 1948 bronze medal winning Olympian. A new book about his life launched Thursday with a celebration at the Heinz History Center. Herb, thank you so much for taking the time. Congratulations.
Thanks again.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Sarah Kovash. Just Ducky Tours announced this week that it will not operate this summer. The repurposed military vehicles are a common sight downtown and in the rivers during the warm months, but owners say sky-high insurance premiums as a result of a fatal duck tour accident in Missouri last year prevented them from operating. And multiple sidewalks along Mount Washington's overlooks will be closed for several months for repairs. It's been 40 years since the walkways were renovated and have recently fallen apart. They're expected to be fixed and operational by Thanksgiving. Find more top stories online at WESA.FM.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Pennsylvania Department of Health says there is no cancer cluster in a Washington County school district. But those who have been affected by the high occurrence of rare tumors there want the state to take a closer look to see if the natural gas industry or other environmental causes could be to blame. For State Impact Pennsylvania at the Allegheny Front's, Reed Frazier has more.
Cindy Vallant is sitting in a booth at a Panera telling the story of her youngest son, Kurt.
He had a smile that would light up a room. Just everybody loved him, you know, because he just had that personality, a magnet personality.
In his first year in college, Kurt started complaining about a pain in his shoulder. A doctor told him it was probably from sleeping on it wrong, but the pain wouldn't go away. A year later, Kurt got a bitter diagnosis, Ewing sarcoma, an extremely rare form of bone cancer.
And he had a very small tumor in his shoulder, but he had a mass in his liver. It was in his liver, lungs, lymph node, and spleen.
Kurt Vallant died 3 years later in 2011. Over the next few years, two other young men in their town of Cecil both died of Ewing sarcoma, which only occurs in about 200 new cases a year in the U.S.
And I said, you know, something's wrong here. Something's really wrong. For as rare as this disease is, how do we get three? Boom, boom, boom.
Among Cindy Vallant's first thoughts was maybe fracking had something to do with Kurt's cancer. More than 1,800 deep shale gas wells have been drilled and fracked in Washington County, the most in the state. Initially, she thought the industry would be good for the farmers in her county, who'd leased their land for drilling.
We'd see that must be the oil rig out there flaring up. Look at that, lighting up the sky. Never, never, ever would I have connected any of this till after Kurt had passed away.
as was first reported in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, three other cases of Ewing sarcoma were identified in the same school district where the Valance lived, and a dozen more cases were identified in nearby Westmoreland County. Now, many in the community want answers. At a recent public meeting, Janice Blanock, whose son Luke was Kurt Valance's neighbor and who also died of Ewing sarcoma, says she doesn't know if anything caused her son's cancer, but she wants the state to find out.
No parent should ever have to watch their child suffer and die, especially when there is even the slightest possibility that it's something in the environment that could be causing.
The Pennsylvania Department of Health looked at the cancer cases in Washington County. It found rates of Ewing sarcoma weren't, quote, consistently or statistically significantly higher than expected there. But that study excluded two recent cases of Ewing sarcoma and one case where the patient's address was misidentified. Ned Kattire, a pediatrician with the Children's Health Alliance, told the crowd there's no shortage of potentially harmful environmental hazards in the area. Acid mine drainage, former uranium and radium sites, and fracking.
Harmful emissions from expanding unconventional natural gas infrastructure, including carcinogenic and endocrine-disrupting chemicals and radiation into the air and water, seriously has to be investigated.
No one from the Department of Health or the governor's office agreed to an interview for this story. Governor Tom Wolf released a statement that said the state had thoroughly regulated the natural gas industry. The industry agrees it's stringently regulated and rejects any attempt to link its practices to any disease. Unlike other cancers, Ewing sarcoma has no known environmental causes. But Evelyn Talbot of the University of Pittsburgh's Graduate School of Public Health says there's some evidence linking pesticide exposure with the disease. She says the best way to test for a cause would be to conduct what's called a case control study. That's where scientists compare information from people who have gotten a disease with a control group of similar people who have not.
Do they have the same background levels of genetic damage, if you're looking at genetic damage, or the same background exposures in your blood?
The Department of Health hasn't yet said whether it's going to conduct any follow-up studies, but said it will review more data as it comes in. Reed Frazier, State Impact Pennsylvania.
And I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. One of Pittsburgh's signature jazz events each year will happen this Sunday aboard a Gateway Clipper boat when drummer Roger Humphreys hosts his annual Jazz on the River boat ride. Roger and 90.5 WESA's Bob Studebaker recently spent some time talking about the event and Roger's career, which started when he was very young.
I've been playing drums ever since I was like 3.5 years old all my life.
I can picture a picture of you as a 3.5 year old on one of your albums. You were the drummer on one of the most significant recordings of the 1960s, Horace Silver's Song for My Father, when you were really young.
That's correct. Matter of fact, I was 20 years old.
And it's a song pretty much everybody recognizes, even if they don't know what they're listening to because of that opening bass line, a landmark in jazz recording. But we're here to talk about other people young in their careers and what you have done to foster young musicians for, how long did you teach at Kappa? Let me go ahead and preface this by saying You were on the road and you worked with Horace Silver. You worked with Ray Charles. What was that like, working with Ray Charles?
That was a great experience because it's my first time ever working with a big band.
Yeah.
And he was a great band leader to me also.
And you saw a lot of the world and then ultimately said, you know what, I want to go back home while my kids are still young. And you did. You returned to Pittsburgh, you raised your family, and you were immersed in the education of young musicians. And that started, well, before you became a faculty member at Kappa, the Creative and Performing Arts High School. But it really, everything kind of gelled when you became a teacher at Kappa. How many years were you at Kappa?
I was at Kappa for 28 years, you know, with my friend Harry Clark, who started that program. Yeah. Well, my whole thing was always to share and try to pass on, you know, what I knew to others.
Not just your musical knowledge, but also your understanding of the business of music and providing the encouragement that young artists need.
You know, a musician is something personal. It's a one-on-one thing.
It's a passion.
Yeah, it's a passion that you have. And you make it happen. You'll find out how to make it happen. I'm just glad to see so many kids that came from Kappa, you know, out in the world, making a living.
So for the 28 years you were at Kappa, and now in your retirement from teaching, you continue to host these annual cruises on one of the Gateway Clipper boats each summer, filled with jazz, your band and others, and these events have provided crucial funds to many aspiring musicians, and you do it for the public too, right?
It's about having a day where people look forward to having fun, you know.
And people do have fun.
Yes, and encouraging the young ones to go to college. And encouragement is one of the greatest things we can give to anybody, no matter what they want to do. Just encourage them and tell them, if you believe you can do that, you can do it.
Yeah, and it's an interesting part of the story that the idea of this boat ride actually began when your son was playing Little League, and your purpose initially was to help kids play baseball. You began a long relationship with the Gateway Clipper boats when you met the owner, John Connolly.
And he said, well, I tell you what, if you pitch in $1,000, I'll pitch in $1,000 with you, and we will contribute that to the kids for the Little League team that they needed some equipment.
And over the years, it's become something
to have fun on every year. And then when I started with Kappa, I started doing the scholarship thing in 1982.
That was. Right.
And the whole thing for me is like, it's about some love. Share some love. Be positive instead of negative, telling somebody what they can't do. You know, maybe you can't do that, but that don't mean that the child or another human being cannot do that. And the whole purpose, one of the whole purpose for me, I look forward to June the 30th, for people to come and have some fun, let it go, whatever is bugging you and bothering you, come and say hi to your friends. And like I said, and just wish the kids well wishes who are going away to school, you know, to become a musician.
All right. People can find the tickets. People can find information. RogerHumphreysBand.com is your website. And it boards at 12:30, takes off from the dock at 1 o'clock, and it's back in at 4 o'clock.
Right, correct, Bob.
Perfect Sunday afternoon of jazz in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, and thank you very much, Bob.
That was drummer Roger Humphreys speaking with WESA's Bob Studebaker. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Whether it's a serious illness of a family member or the birth of a baby, workers often have to take time off to provide care for their loved ones. But according to the Labor Department, only 1 in 7 workers have access to company-provided paid family leave. Momentum is growing for paid family leave in Pennsylvania. We're going to talk about the potential impact of the proposed Family Care Act on workers and businesses with Heather Arnay, CEO of the Women and Girls Foundation. Heather, welcome to The Confluence.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
And on the line from Harrisburg is State Representative Dan Miller, a Democrat from Allegheny County. Representative, thanks for joining us. Representative, are you there? All right. We'll clear up that connection in just a moment. So, Heather, I want to start with you. What do you feel is the intended impact of this legislation on workers who don't have access to that paid family leave currently?
Well, you know, the first thing is I think that people are usually shocked to learn how many people don't have access to any kind of paid family or medical leave. So, Gavin, you'll probably be surprised to learn that only 14% of workers in this country have access to any kind of paid family or medical leave. And when we talk about paid family or medical leave, what we're talking about is not even maternity leave. What we're talking about is everything, right? So if you get hit by a car and you need to take off of work because you've been hit by a car, right? That's paid medical leave. Right. Mm-hmm. So at some point in our lives, every single worker, every single person is going to need paid leave. Right. Either we're going to need care or we're going to need care for somebody. But only 14% of workers have access to it right now.
Right. So it's going to affect a lot of people.
So it's going to affect 100% of workers. Right. 100% of people in Pennsylvania will benefit from this. And that's what's so powerful. Every family, everybody across the board. It's an incredible policy because it has the ability to raise the economic security of families across the state. And what I love about this legislation is it's great for small business, it's great for workers, and it's great for families.
Why has it been a top priority for Women and Girls Foundation? Why so?
Well, you know, when we did our 2017 through 20 strategic plan, so when we were working on it in those 2016 year, what we really looked at was we wanted to work on a public policy that had the ability to impact women across the age spectrum, right? Across socioeconomic status, sexual orientation, race, neighborhood, right? We wanted to look at something that had the ability to impact as many families and women as possible. And it really was striking, this policy issue and how it impacts so many families. When you think about elder care, so we were talking to families, we did town halls, we did polling, and what's incredible is this issue polls so highly. There's hardly anything that polls, you know, over 50% with everybody. Republicans, Democrats, independents, men, women, over 75% of Pennsylvanians want paid family and medical leave. And when you tell folks that it covers elder care, that goes to over 81%. And that's especially with Republican voters, not just Democratic voters. And that's because elder care is such a big issue in this country and in our state especially. And so for women, you might be surprised. You know, most folks think about infant care. And yes, that's important. Our country, our state, has one of the highest infant mortality rates. We have one of the highest maternal mortality rates, especially for women of color. But the average caregiver in our country is a 65-year-old woman.
That's the caregiver, not the care receiver.
The average caregiver is a 65-year-old woman taking care of her mother, who's in her 80s. Mm. And that's why AARP is one of our strongest coalition partners in this state.
All right. We're joined now by State Representative Dan Miller of Allegheny County. Good morning, Representative. How are you?
Good morning, and thanks for bringing me on.
Representative, I wanted to ask you, is this an issue that's sort of been resonating with your constituents? Have you been hearing individual stories and saying, yes, Representative, we need this. Please push for this.
You know, it's a never-ending story in one way or another. You know, so much of the middle class, even some a little bit above, definitely those below, have been struggling to do what they need to do in relation to home and taking care of what matters the most. Yes, it's never been quiet as an issue. To be honest, it's only growing, especially in certain sectors where we're seeing some aging issues that come up. And also, even on the other side, we're having grandparents who are raising kids and how they're coordinating those aspects of things, too. Some grandparents who are still working and then finding themselves that they have to be at IEP meetings or other things that come into play. It's across the spectrum no matter where you are.
You mentioned never-ending. You're hearing about this continuously. Is there a story or two or something that really sort of stuck with you that really opened your eyes, though?
You know, a lot of it, and I just referenced part of it, but a lot of what I often come across, too, is when, especially in relation to issues involving disabilities that come up to play. I'll give you an example. Let's just say that for a traditional parent or grandparent who's helping to raise a child in one way or the other, they have, teacher conferences that come up, you know, for things with it. By the same token, those with an IEP have a whole myriad of other things that come into play in relation for that IEP to work, be created for the evaluations that are necessary to be done in order to be sure that the child's educational needs are being met. Well, those incidents that come up, you can have several meetings easily in a semester that are very challenging. You're not going to be able to schedule these meetings at 8 o'clock at night. So you're going to have to find ways to work that through. And if you don't go, then it often won't happen, or your child's interests are not represented, and definitely the parent's interests are not represented. And that's just in dealing with aspects of an IEP creation. Those are where I often come across just the challenges of being able to say, like, look, I need to be sure that I'm at a meeting with my child's occupational therapist, my child's physical therapist, something along that line, speech therapist is going to be sure that those things are being done. And while that sounds small, but don't forget, if you have a 45-minute or a 30-minute or a 60-minute meeting, you have everything that you need to do to get there, to process it, to be part of it, and to be sure that you're collecting the information you need at the end of it to be sure that the plan is being implemented. So, yes, those are realistic scenarios that are happening every day to people, not just in my district, but everywhere. If you are a working family, it's a challenge.
Heather?
Yeah, I think that also there's the issues that folks don't even the populations of people don't even think about this impacts. And so one of those that's been really striking to me is our veterans. So when folks are in active service, they have access to paid medical and family leave. Our armed services know that this is an important benefit for our soldiers. But what happens is right now, especially for our 9/11 veterans, for our folks who have served in Afghanistan and Iraq, is that a lot of what they're coming home with are unfortunately things that are long lasting. And so what we've heard from the Veterans Breakfast Group, from our veterans coalition partners, is that things like burn pit injuries and post-traumatic stress injuries and brain traumatic brain injuries and other kinds of physical injuries are long-term, right, physical injuries. And unfortunately, as veterans, they don't have those benefits long-term. And so when they are in the private sector, right, as workers years later, they don't have access to paid family and medical leave, which means that when they need, right, to take time off to care for their own injuries, they don't have paid time off. And the people who care for them don't have time to take off. So this is an issue that really impacts our veterans and families who care for our veterans, and that's why they are coalition partners.
There's currently a federally mandated Family and Medical Leave Act that applies to, I believe, some Pennsylvania businesses and organizations. Representative, how would the Family Care Act in Pennsylvania differ from that or complement that or other?
Yeah, keep in mind in this, everybody's in.
So one really important difference is, so the federal FMLA, one important difference is that's unpaid, right? So most American workers can't live past 2 weeks without going into bankruptcy, without income. So first, the federal FMLA doesn't cover all businesses, right? So most workers actually work for businesses that have less than 100 employees. So you wouldn't even have access to FMLA. But even if you did, it would be unpaid. So the Family Care Act provides paid family and medical leave to all workers. So those are two really big differences, right? Everyone's covered. Almost everyone, you have to work a certain number of up to a certain amount of money, but that threshold is very low, and it's paid. That's a huge difference. We asked folks, hundreds of folks at town hall meetings throughout the last several years, what the biggest impact was to them for not having access to paid family and medical leave, and the first thing we heard was bankruptcy.
Bankruptcy. It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. We're talking about the proposed Family Care Act in Pennsylvania with Heather Arnay. She's CEO of the Women and Girls Foundation. And State Representative Dan Miller of Allegheny County joins us on the line from Harrisburg. Representative, where does the proposal stand? Has it been officially introduced in the House at this point?
It's officially introduced in the Senate. It's done the first hurdle of introduction in the House. Obviously, we are in the midst of finishing the remaining parts of the state budget here in June. But I do, obviously, our hope is that we're going to get some action on this and continue to grow our coalition of support, both in and outside the legislature in the fall.
Okay, and briefly, who's going to pay for this, though? How is this going to be paid for paid family leave?
Well, keep in mind that this is where the deal has been structured, is that you're going to have, this is from the employee side, where you're going to have, if I remember, it's going to be less than, Heather, help me out with it, less than 0.6%.
It's less than a penny on every dollar. So what's the reason why these programs are so popular? So what folks should know and why we think this is so possible is that there are so many other states who've already passed these laws and are already implementing these programs. So New York, New Jersey, Massachusetts, Washington, D.C., Rhode Island, Connecticut now. If you've noticed, I've now mentioned almost every single Northeast state that we share borders with. California was the first many, many years ago. But all our neighbors, basically, in the Northeast corridor now have this model. And so how it works, it's self-sustaining. Every employee pays into it, a penny on a dollar.
Okay, that every means, employee.
So that's just like, employee. So it's just like Social Security, workers' compensation, right? So we're all paying in a very tiny amount. We barely even notice. And we all have access to it. And that means that if you, so remember earlier I mentioned only 14% of workers have access to any kind of paid family or medical leave now. And if you're self-employed, you get to decide whether you want to pay in or not. I can't tell you how many conversations I've had with Uber and Lyft drivers in the last over the last year who give me their email address so that I can sign them up for our newsletter and action alert so they can be part of this coalition. Because all they say to me is, I don't have access to any kind of paid leave in this gig economy. And everybody needs it because they don't, you know, they don't have any kind of coverage if something happens to them or their family, or they want to have, you know, a baby. So this is what's really beautiful about this model, is that employees are paying in a very tiny amount. And in return, they're having access to several weeks of paid leave, and small businesses and businesses are paying nothing.
That's what I wanted to ask you, Representative. We have just 2 minutes left. How does this impact businesses? But what if they have to hire, say, a temp to fill in for that person?
Right. Well, they'd be paying the same salary they're paying that other person.
Representative?
Yeah, listen, there's no doubt. The biggest benefit to the employers is going to be a healthier and a better prepared worker that's going to come into play. So if you have to juggle, if your employee has massive problems that are causing stress, distraction, just the typical realities of dealing with somebody who's sick at home, this is going to provide that relief. It's going to be sure that when they are at work, they're the sharpest they're ever going to be. They are ready, prepared, and they are feeling better about making sure that things are cared for at home. They're going to have a sharper workforce by being sure that they have access to taking care of the family needs that they need to do. So, look, there's no doubt to me that there's, like everything, there's a bit of a compromise that comes into play. I have seen other bills designed in the legislature that have been more employer-based as far as support, financial support for it. This is a compromise, is it? But it's in recognition of our changing workforce over the last, in particular, 40 years in relation to families working. And it's also in relation to the idea that we need to do better. We can and should be doing better to support families up and down. And that's what's been so great about making this compromise, is pulling those strands together, thanks to the efforts of groups like the Women and Girls Foundation, that I think can pull left and right together and be sure that we're giving Pennsylvanians a better way to take care of their family needs and still be productive at the workplace.
Representative, yes or no, will this legislation get passed in this legislative session? Yes or no?
I pray that it does.
All right. Heather Arnay, you've been working on this for years. Are you confident this is the time to do it? We have just 20 seconds.
I'll say yes, because we are, this bill is bipartisan. And it's bipartisan for exactly the reasons you just heard. It's supported by Republicans and Democrats, and it was introduced by Republicans and Democrats from both sides of our state. Senator Laughlin is the lead sponsor in the Senate from Erie, and Representative Wendy Thomas is Representative Miller's counterpart in the House, and she's out of Bucks County, out of Philadelphia. And so we have, and Marie Collette out of Bucks County is Senator Laughlin's partner in the Senate. So we, in both chambers, have Republicans, Democrats, men, women, both sides of the state. Right. It's incredible. There's such strong support, and that's why we think it'll pass this session.
And that's where we're going to have to leave it right now. Heather Arnay is CEO of the Women and Girls Foundation. State Representative Dan Miller is a Democrat from Allegheny County. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, the Supreme Court has issued some close rulings on everything from gerrymandering to a citizenship question on the census. How might this affect Pennsylvanians? Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance by Avery Keatley, Julia Maruka, and Hannah Gaskill. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good weekend of good news.